Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Monday, February 20th. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. I'm your host, Magnus Tiewald, and I'll be with you for the next hour or so. It's a holiday Monday, family day here in British Columbia, and similar holidays across many other provinces in Canada. So I hope you've been enjoying your long weekend, getting out and doing some fun stuff with family because it's a family day weekend, or whatever it is you like to do with the extra time off that comes with a three-day weekend. I know for some schools, some students, such as my daughter, is a lovely four-day weekend because they had a Pro D day on Friday, so 4 days off, and those are always extra special. Anyway, we've got a good show for you today. We're going to start off with our new regular segment, What's Up in Burnaby, with Srishti Gangdev of the Burnaby Beacon. And we're going to be talking about some of the big stories in Burnaby this week. A little later on, we have Looking at Lyme. And we finish off with a CJSF-produced documentary about a family story, although not necessarily a sunny family story, about escaping from war-torn Guatemala during the 1980s, and coming to Canada to find a new life for their family. That's all coming up this hour on Speak Up. But first, this is Vancouver's Apollo Ghosts and Surfer's Ear.
I cut my finger on an oyster shell that I skipped across the beach. Found a maple leaf to wrap it in. The cut was pretty fucking deep. Walking back, I'm bleeding out. Like dripping ice cream in the heat. If I fainted here right now, would you find me in the trees? I believe this shit would go away. How did I forget the dumb cliche? Why is it so hard for me to say I love you? That's when I got close to heartless. That's when I got close to heartless. That's when I got close to heartless. But she harbored a desire to do good things where it's possible to navigate by feel.
Welcome to the show today, Srishti. We are speaking to Srishti Gangdev, and we're going to be talking about what's up in Burnaby this week. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, as always.
Srishti is a reporter with the Burnaby Beacon, and we're going to talk a bit about some of the interesting stories happening in Burnaby this week. One of the interesting stories is new ridings or rearranged ridings for Burnaby as a result of the last census, and the new ridings are meeting much more approval than the very first proposal for realignment. For starters, what was the problem with the previous proposal for realigning and rearranging the ridings in Burnaby?
Yeah, so the first proposal actually took Burnaby, which currently has 3 ridings, and split it up into 6. And only one of those ridings was actually solely located in Burnaby.
Right, so Burnaby wasn't getting 3 new ridings.
Yeah, it wasn't that, you know, we were having more MPs dedicated to Burnaby residents in particular. Like, for instance, I live in the Metrotown area, and currently I am represented by Burnaby South. And if this proposal originally had gone through, I would have actually been in the Vancouver South Fraser View riding, which I believe is currently represented by Harjeet Sajjan. But I would be one of 7% of Burnaby residents who were part of that. So there was a lot of concern that, you know, these tiny little sections of Burnaby were being put into these ridings that had much larger populations than other municipalities and wouldn't actually be getting the representation that we need.
Right. So in the current situation in Burnaby, as you said, there's 3 ridings, which are pretty much centered on Burnaby, and those 3 MPs effectively are representing Burnaby, whereas in the proposal from last year, the first proposal for realigning these ridings, now instead of having 3 Burnaby ridings, there were going to be 6 ridings that were essentially shared with all the surrounding communities, and, mm-hmm. and in some cases, like your riding, just small parts of the riding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so 2 of the ridings that we currently have are, you know, shared with other municipalities, but the population split is quite equal. So it's not like, you know, Terry Beach represents more North Vancouver residents than he does Burnaby residents or anything like that. But in the ridings that they had originally proposed, there was a huge split between, you know, who is actually representing a huge portion of Burnaby residents.
And this didn't go over that well with Burnaby folks. And the Burnaby mayor sort of led the opposition to that. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. So they had quite a lengthy period of public consultation in a lot of municipalities, including Burnaby and New West. And I think there was one in North Vancouver as well. And pretty much everyone who saw this come across their desk said, you know, this is not the way to do it in Burnaby. The mayor in particular was quite outspoken about it. He told the commission that I think he presented some data showing that no other municipality of, you know, Burnaby's size. So if you look at places like Regina, nowhere had been fragmented in the same kind of way. And he really urged the commission to look at it from a different angle. And it seems like they did. So instead of getting 3 extra ridings, if this proposal goes ahead as it's laid out right now, Burnaby will have 1 more riding.
And people seem to be a lot happier with this result.
I haven't heard kind of the same, you know, immediate what the heck is going on kind of reaction as we did the first time around. There's no more public consultation going forward. So it's been tabled in the House of Commons. The commission will now hear, you know, any objections from members of parliament themselves. And based on that, it's kind of like a reworking period. But this is kind of how it will be more or less going forward.
Right. And sort of what are the new ridings, roughly speaking?
Yeah, so it's, you know, more or less the same. Burnaby North Seymour doesn't change all that much. New Westminster Burnaby changes a little bit in that it loses some land from the Burnaby side, but gains some land from Coquitlam, actually. So it's going to be New Westminster Burnaby Mallardville. And I think the biggest change is that instead of Burnaby South, we've now got that section of Burnaby has been kind of split into 2 ridings. So I will actually, you know, the example that I gave before, I believe it's going to be it's going to be quite similar to that. So I'll be part of the Vancouver South Fraser rewriting, but there's a bigger portion of Burnaby that's now moving over to that. So it's less of a question of there's only 10 Burnaby residents in that writing. And then the last writing that we'll see is Burnaby Central, which is more or less what we currently see in Burnaby South.
And do we know yet how this is going to affect some of the incumbents in those ridings?
It's going to be interesting to watch because the biggest change that I see is the Jagmeet Singh Harjeet Sajjan matchup there.
Right.
So
two it's, very very high profile politicians.
Yeah, very high profile politicians. Both probably have their name recognition to thank for at least a portion of their votes. So I can't imagine that Jagmeet Singh would want to threaten that position that he has in any way. So if you're asking for my prediction, I would say he's going to run in Burnaby Central. And it's likely that a portion of Burnaby will be represented by Harjeet Sajjan or whoever wins in that riding, which is interesting because Burnaby has been an NDP town for, decades. Mm-hmm. Especially the south of Burnaby, and here's an opportunity, I would say, for the Liberals to get some more ground. They've got Terry Beach and potentially whoever wins in Vancouver South.
All very interesting, and I guess we're a couple years away from the next election where we'll see this all playing out, but
that's right.
The pieces are starting to fall into place. A story we talked about last week is continuing to make the news. That was the proposal, or is the proposal, to put a waste treatment facility on 21 acres of Fraser Foreshore Park. And that's continuing to stir up controversy and opposition. What's been happening there?
It's funny because a lot of times we hear from Burnaby residents that it's hard to keep up with what's going on in municipal politics. And it doesn't, people think that municipal politics doesn't really affect their day to day. This is an example where everyone has an opinion. We've gotten more letters on this topic than I think a lot of other topics we've reported on. I know that our competitors over at the Burnaby Now have been getting tons of input on this as well from the public. And there's a bunch of different community groups that are basically launching petitions or action against this proposed waste facility that we talked about last week. So if you need a refresher, the city council is looking at taking quite a large portion of Fraser Foreshore Park and turning it into an organic waste recycling facility. And it's very rare that we see parkland being undedicated, of course.
And part of the argument from the city side is this is parkland that's not particularly used a lot by people. Mm-hmm. But I think some of the opposition is that people are using it and a lot of the land is wetland and other environments that actually are already very much under threat in urban areas. And so whether people are using it or not maybe isn't even all that important a factor in deciding whether it's actually important to preserve it.
Yeah, that's certainly some of what we've heard, in that, even if it's not frequented by dog walkers or tennis players per se, it's an important ecological component of that park and is home to a lot of different wildlife species.
So what's the process from here? I mean, this is an issue that this is a proposal that's just coming up, so it's a long way from happening yet. What sort of, roughly speaking, is the process and how long will it take?
So as far as I'm aware, the city is proposing that, since they're planning on taking away that section of land, they'll find another section of land to make up for it. But I think you can expect that this will go to public hearing, and that public hearing will be quite lengthy because it seems like people have a lot to say about it. I think there's also permits required from different levels of government to go ahead with this. If it happens, it's a long way off, but it'll really be interesting to see whether council, takes into account this criticism that they've been hearing from about the project.
All right. On a more fun note, you folks at the Burnaby Beacon are launching a Reader's Choice Awards.
Yeah, we are so, so excited about this. This is the first ever Burnaby Beacon Reader's Choice Awards that we're launching. And basically, we just, we talk a lot about the places to eat in the city and the places to have a drink. And we wanted to hear from everyone else. So we're asking for people to sign up for our newsletter, and that'll allow them to nominate their favorite restaurants and favorite watering holes in the city. And from there, we'll do a voting process and kind of rank these people.
Great. So what sort of categories are you thinking about?
I think we have 25 categories in this first ever set of awards that we're doing. They do at the moment all revolve around food and drink, but I think we've got, you know, best pizza, best sushi, best bubble tea. Of course, there's a huge bubble tea culture in the city, so we're really interested to see what people's favorites are, you know, best Vietnamese food. Kind of every category of restaurant you can think of is listed in these awards.
Great. And so you mentioned people. Well, why don't you tell me when are you sort of formally launching the process, and how do people jump in and get involved?
Yeah. So the nomination process actually launched last Monday. So all you need to do is go to readerschoice.burnabybeacon.com, or you can go to our homepage, burnabybeacon.com. There's a link right at the top there that'll take you to the right page. You just need to sign up for our newsletter. And the reason we're doing that is because we obviously want to make sure that, you know, we're not, you know, the nominations aren't being padded or right. anything like that. Got to keep things fair. So you just enter your email. From there, you'll be taken to our like kind of nomination portal. And there's no like multiple choice or anything. This is just an opportunity for you to enter in the name of your favorite restaurant for each of these categories.
Great. Sounds like fun. Thanks for joining me today. Those are some interesting stuff happening. Quickly, all these stories are available on your website if people want to read more, or they can grab the newsletter. Tell us how to do that.
Yeah. So like I said, just sign up for our newsletter, burnabybeacon.com. You enter your email and you're going to get a curated newsletter of everything Burnaby in your email inbox every weekday. And that's news, events, food, all the fun stuff.
Well, thanks a lot. That's What's Up in Burnaby this week. Thank you, Srishti.
Thanks so much for having me.
We will be back next week with What's Up in Burnaby with Srishti Gangdeep from the Burnaby Beacon. Thanks for joining me today.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
This is Bird Note. Swans like this Hooper swan are impressive animals. They're among the largest flying birds around today. But 11.5 million years ago, two extinct species from Japan took an even more epic direction. Like today's swans, Anica cygna hajime and Anica cygna yoshiensis were quite large. But unlike their modern relatives, these birds lived most of their lives out at sea, and their fossils reveal remarkable adaptations to this unusual lifestyle. They had wide, spatula-shaped beaks, somewhat like modern shoveler ducks. The dense bones of their wide hips let them remain stable on choppy waters while filtering plankton from the sea surface with their oversized heads. Their wings weren't built for flight, but had the musculature and range of motion to suggest they weren't useless. In combination with the flexible tail, they could form a cradle for carrying chicks on their back, which some swans still do now with their young. The remarkable anatomy of Anica cygna reveals a creature uniquely adapted to thrive in an environment quite unlike what you'd expect for a swan. To quote the scientists who named it in a 2022 study, in a sense, it is the ultimate bird that ever existed. For Bird Note, I'm Ade Ben Salahuddin.
You're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. If you're looking for something to do this week, and actually they extend for a few weeks more, you might be interested in these exhibitions put on by SFU at their downtown campuses. Both exhibitions are free and open to the public. Francisco Fernando Granada's Who Claims Abstraction is on at the Tech Gallery throughout this year. That's at 515 West Hastings in SFU Harbor Center. His work combines exercises in line work and color harmony with immersive installation of digital prints on vinyl and is at the Tech Gallery. You can also check out Carolyn Itter's exhibition, Please Meet the Geese Who Have Lived Here Forever, Set, Properties, and Film. This exhibition focuses on the result of resource extraction, marine pollution, and ecological extinction. The set itself is dynamic, and the materials are gathered only from secondhand shops, alleyways, and backyards of the artist's neighborhood. Please Meet the Geese Who Have Lived Here Forever is at the Audain Gallery, 149 West Hastings, at the SFU Goldcorp Center for the Arts until March 11th.
This is not a test. On this Looking at Lyme, we head all the way to Munich, Germany, and to meet a doctor who is on the leading edge of testing for Lyme and other infections. Come along for the ride. We're going to meet Dr. Armin Schwarzbach. Dr. Armin Schwarzbach has been studying diagnostic tests for Borrelia burgdorferi and co-infections for over 15 years. In that time, he has tested over 50,000 patients. He's one of the leading experts on Lyme disease testing and other pathogens. He joins us from Munich. Welcome, Armin, to our podcast. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. Hello, how are you? I'm here in Germany, sitting in a hot atmosphere.
Armin, how did you become involved in working with Lyme disease and other tick-borne illnesses?
To make a longer story short, I diagnosed a so-called multiple sclerosis patient in 2004-2005, and I did a special test for this patient. It was named the ELISpot, or lymphocyte transformation test that time, and the patient was without any antibodies, nothing in the bloodstream, suffering from multiple sclerosis, treated with corticosteroids, nearly dying, sitting in a wheelchair, no possibility to get healthy again. I did this test on her, and I was surprised that she was positive for Borrelia burgdorferi, the pathogen for Lyme disease. And after that, the doctor called me, a therapist, oh, could it be maybe neuroborreliosis? And I said, I don't know, because multiple sclerosis, and neuroborreliosis, But he treated her by my advice, by these findings in this test without antibodies, and no antibodies in spinal fluid, no antibodies in the bloodstream, and the patient is cured until now. Days. So this was a lucky case, and it changed completely my medical world completely.
Oh, I can imagine that just knocked you on a new trajectory. And then, so how did you then become involved in laboratory work and improving the testing?
Yeah, because I saw in this that the antibodies are not reliable. Antibodies, ELISA is worst case scenario, don't trust in ELISA. It's around 15% sensitivity, we name it. So very common false negative. The Western blot, forget the Western blots. What is it telling Western blots? It's a screening test for transmission of Borrelia burgdorferi, but no activity test. And so when I started with this, I came to the cellular analytical part of laboratory medicine. I'm in laboratory now for 40 years, so I worked in biochemistry, but I never have seen such cases where no antibodies, but cellular immune reactions.
Oh, that's so fascinating. So why do people send their blood to you in Germany for testing? How would that testing be different compared to what we have here in Canada?
In Germany, I have some, you would say, competitors or other laboratories offering similar tests or maybe same tests. So this was not clear that time to me that some are caring also in Germany for this project. So I'm not alone offering this cellular analytics in Germany. But in other countries, when I traveled around and people contacted me, patients for getting this test, nobody is doing the test in Canada or in Australia or in South Africa or in many other European countries, very surprisingly.
And so what is the difference between direct and indirect testing?
Yeah, direct test is you need to get a biopsy from a bull's rash as an example. You isolate the pathogen, in this case Borrelia burgdorferi, and you do a culture on it, and you do a PCR on it. This is a direct test. You find directly the pathogen. It's similar to SARS-CoV-2 swabs PCR. Okay, but if you do an indirect test, this is the part of humoral and cellular immune responses. This is a part of antibodies and T-cellular immune responses. That's different. This is indirect detection of pathogens in the bloodstream, which is easy to do.
Oh, and then what is the difference between B cells and T cells and how those impact the immune response or the antibody response?
B cells are the antibodies and the T cells are the lymphocytes. Antibodies are proteins. Lymphocytes are living cells, living individuals fighting against pathogens. And in the whole diagnostic world, I think they are underrepresented, so nobody is caring for cellular tests. We have some tests for tuberculosis. It's named the QuantiFERON test. This is astonishingly, it's CDC preferred test, this interferon gamma release assay. But for Lyme disease, this is, as an example, not accepted. Very interesting.
Okay. Can you help me understand, because I always find this part confusing, what is the difference between IgG and IgM?
Yeah, these are both markers for systemic infections. So if a pathogen is penetrating your body, normally you should produce IgM antibodies, the antibodies of the first phase of your immune answer of your humoral, the Th2 immune system. After a while, you produce IgG antibodies, which are long-term antibodies. So the half-lifetime of these antibodies is different. The IgG can persist over months, years, and the IgM just for a very few weeks. But interestingly, in Lyme disease, we have persistencies of IgM antibodies for years without IgG antibodies.
Okay, so, and we also interviewed Dr. Leona Gilbert from Finland in episode 14. So she was speaking to us about your TickPlex test. And it was really exciting to hear that you can test for so many different microbes. Could you tell our listeners a little bit more about the TickPlex?
Yeah, this a longer story also. The TickPlex was developed because we saw together with Professor Gilbert that we have persister forms, round bodies of Borrelia burgdorferi, and intracellular persister forms, some name it cysts or L forms or pleomorphic forms, however you want to name these round bodies. And we sat together in a sauna, in a Finnish sauna, drinking some beer. It's some years ago. Yes, it was 2000, I don't remember exactly, 2012 or so. We said, why should we not test for these persister form antibodies? Why not? And that was a breakthrough because we found around 98% now with a persister form antibodies. And by this, Leon Gilbert, she's a medical, a test producer professional. I'm a medical professional. I helped her in with patients and she did this TickPlex test. And the TickPlex has also really a very interesting point. We found also that all of these patients that multiple infections, so-called co-infections from tick bites or reactivated infections, we name it opportunistic infections, viruses, and so on. So she designed a panel for that, for these co-infections, the first ELISA in the world. The ELISA technique is more sensitive than IFA, immune fluorescence assays, much better test. We like that test in our laboratories. So she developed also a broad-ranged 20 IgG, IgM together, a combination for chlamydia, for mycoplasma, for Epstein-Barr virus, for Bartonella rickettsia, all of these co-infections, Ehrlichia. So why not to check for patients with such a test panel? Because we find in every patient multiple infections. There's not one patient I diagnose with just Lyme disease. They all have different infections, or they don't have Lyme disease at this moment. They have other co-infections or other opportunistic infections. So why not to check for multiple infections?
And then I've heard you refer to both co-infections and opportunistic infections. What is the difference between those and how they manifest in the body?
Yeah, the co-infections are, don't name it co-infections, I don't like this word. I like more infection or tick-borne diseases, infections coming from a tick bite, vector-borne infections. These are Bartonella, This is Ehrlichia anaplasma, this is Babesia, and this Rickettsia, the big four ones. Also, we have now Borrelia miyamotoi, number five. This is directly transmitted by a vector, these pathogens. The